From the Sky News Centre at 5, the terror suspects involved in two separate sieges in France have been killed after police launched coordinated assaults to rescue several hostages. Two armed brothers suspected of a massacre in Paris on Wednesday died when officers stormed an industrial unit in a town northeast of the capital. Gunfire and explosions could be heard at the site at Damartin, Angoulême. Sky's Jeremy Thompson's there.
Column after column of police vehicle, ambulance and all sorts of official resources being poured into the site of the hostage situation just up the road from here.
Another gunman holding people at a Jewish supermarket in eastern Paris was also killed. Sky's Kay Burley and Martin Brunt were near the scene as police stormed the shop.
Five or six explosions
now. Six explosions now.
So it certainly appears that the hostage situation here is coming to an end in some way.
Now, it's understood many of the hostages have been freed, although there are reports four have been killed. The gunmen were behind two terror attacks in the capital, where a total of 13 people were shot dead. In other news, A&E waiting times in England had begun the year well below target. Just 86.7% of patients were seen within 4 hours last week. The private healthcare operator that chose to run an NHS hospital trust says it wants to withdraw from its contract because of cuts. Circle Holdings took on Hitching Brook in Cambridgeshire in 2012 when it was facing closure. And further rain and strong winds are expected across northern parts of the UK later. Another vigorous area of low pressure is moving in and will hit Scotland, Northern Ireland and northern parts of England and Wales. Gusts of more than 100 miles an hour have left tens of thousands of homes in Scotland without power. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth William.
It's Friday. Happy New Year. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Conservative councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the perils of tabloid journalism in the person of former Daily Star reporter turned stand-up comic Richard Pepiat. And apparently he's had no shortage of material for his new job from his old one. He's got a film out now too called One Rogue Reporter. And it's never been elected, but it's more powerful than our Westminster government. I'm talking, of course, about the most powerful body in the EU, the European Commission. And author Dave Barnby joins me after six to reveal the deals done by the then Tory Prime Minister Ted Heath behind closed doors in 1975 when Britain first joined the forerunner of the European Union, the EEC. Then, this week's terror attacks in France. Europe's most horrific attack since 2011 when Anders Breivik in Norway killed 77 young socialists in Norway. Wednesday's massacre of 12 people at the offices of Charlie Hebdo magazine, plus a follow-up attack near a metro station. And today, the two sieges just ended less than an hour ago, one at an industrial estate and one at a Paris supermarket. Plus, I'll be asking Martin Summers about the forthcoming Greek elections, all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, wet and windy. This weekend, highs of 13, getting colder as Saturday progresses, windy with sunshine and showers on both days, Saturday and Sunday. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, windy with sunshine and showers this week. Next weekend, that's the 17th and 18th of January, highs of 2 Celsius. Great high, is that? Sunny but cold. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott. Hi, Claire, and welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, let's just get instantly your reaction to events in Paris because and in France, because this is quite a horrible way for this all to end, with gunmen basically from the security services going into both of these sieges.
Well, you know, I think we all knew it wasn't going to end well, but this is absolutely the most tragic outcome. We're yet to see the truth of how many hostages have been killed. I think this is, it's probably shaken everybody, and we realise that terrorism affects everybody. And it strikes at any time, and there is nothing good ever comes from terrorism. And I think we're all standing with the French people in absolute sadness, and just a real tragedy has unfolded today, and I think we're all moved by it.
Well, it is all on our home turf, but of course many Muslims have been dying, probably tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, since 9/11 over in the Middle East, which is very far away. Do you think that this sort of thing is inevitable?
I don't think this sort of thing's inevitable, actually. I think you can distinguish between war and terrorism quite clearly, and war is one thing, and obviously, unfortunately, it involves civilian casualties, which everybody tries to keep to a minimum. But this is just a mindless attack on the free speech and innocent people. And I don't think there's ever an excuse for mindless violence of this nature.
I mean, if you were an ordinary Iraqi, for example, you're seeing soldiers going down, people being blown up, etc., firefights going on in your hometown, you might see the Western soldiers as terrorists.
You may see Western soldiers as terrorists. I think the majority of people don't see Western soldiers as terrorists. And I think, judging by the response of the Muslim population in Bristol, I think, you know, violence in terms of terrorism is quite different. And it's been great to know that the Muslim populations in France have been utterly condemning what's been going on here. And I don't think you can draw parallels between war and terrorism.
Martin, can I just bring you in? What are your thoughts about this? Certainly looks like some kind of blowback attack, really a reaction against foreign wars, particularly, you know, obviously there's been a whole load of history of terrorism with in France, with the problems with Algeria, hasn't there, for example, over the years?
Well, yes, in actual fact, during the 1950s, there were much bigger attacks in France, attacks on the metro and assassinations of large numbers of civilian protesters by police and so on. I'm afraid, you know, it's too early for us to actually... I mean, obviously, right-thinking people condemn this violence, but the actual... who actually carried it out, what their motives were, still not clear. And, of course, one of the things that's quite obvious, I mean, it's that these guys have had some kind of military training and that they've been in Syria. And as Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, said a couple of years ago on French TV, when he was foreign minister, he was approached at an international meeting by British officials, and he stressed that they were British officials.
It was a party in London, apparently.
Yes. And they said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" Now, if British special forces have, as I think they probably have, been involved in training jihadi freedom fighters, if you want to call them that, inside Syria, in Turkey and in Jordan, it may well be that these chaps have been through the hands of our own special forces to be trained.
Okay, well, we'll leave that for there and discuss it more after 6 o'clock. And let's start, because we've had both of the main party leaders sort of in the beginning of 2015, that is David Cameron and Ed Miliband, both sort of pitching for the forthcoming general election this year. It's a first fixed-term parliament, as Andrew Marr pointed out at the weekend. Claire, what's your thoughts about what the main planks are going to be of the Conservative manifesto in the run-up to May?
I think our obviously the main plank of the manifesto is going to be a long-term economic plan, and really continuing the recovery into the next 5 years. I think seeing nearly 2 million people employed, more than in the last government, I think we're going to be building on employment, infrastructure, and the economy, because it's only when the country is actually financially buoyant is that we can invest in all the things that we'd love to invest in, which is schools and hospitals and good roads and all the things that make Britain a civilised and good place to live.
Well, the national debt is 1.2 trillion and climbing rapidly.
It is.
So, I mean, we're never going to pay that off, are we? So when are we going to have the money to spend on schools and hospitals, as you say?
Well, the thing is that debt is debt, and we have got to get it down. And we have been getting the deficit down, and I know the debt is still climbing, but unless we do take very seriously that it is our debt and we have got to pay it off, we will be in trouble for generations to come. I think we can't bury our heads in the sand saying that, oh, we owe so much money, we mustn't worry about it anymore. Actually, we've got to get a hold of our spending and correct things, unfortunately.
Well, there is another option, that is to stick two fingers up to the banks and say, you can sing for your money, we're the government, we're in charge, you're not having it.
Yeah, but you know, how would you feel, you know, if you had lent somebody some money and they stuck two fingers up at you and said, well, we're not paying you back because we're more important? That's absolutely outrageous. You know, if a government thinks they can afford to borrow something, they ought to plan for paying it back, just in the same way as if I took out a loan on a credit card, I'd be paying it back. Unfortunately, I think the last government thought they never had to pay it back, and as long as they could pay the interest payments, it was all very fine. But actually, there is a point when you really have maxed out the country's credit card, and we had that 5 years ago, and we are working our way towards getting that sorted. But it is nobody's under any illusions that this money has got to be paid back. We are in debt. If you are in debt, you have to sort it. It's time we grown up and acted responsibly in cutting our cloth, our coats according to our cloth.
Now, what if we have to cut our clothes so much according to our cloth that we've got no clothes left? And I mean, that's one of the things that seems to be happening. I mean, Cameron's talking about another 30 billion of cuts to public services in the next parliament, possibly.
I think when I've looked at some of the ways that the public services were run, the efficiencies that we've managed to put in place over the last 5 years are quite amazing. You know, when you hear some crazy stories about different government departments paying six times the amount for the same service from a particular company, there was a long way to go in efficiency savings. And I think, you know, we've got technology and things like that which we are really saving money on, and I think the British people do deserve a government that is thrifty. I don't thank anybody for wasting my money. I'm sure that everybody listening, when they work hard and they pay their tax, they hope that the government spends it very wisely.
I mean, there's been all sorts of problems, haven't there? Over the last 2 weeks, we've seen the worst waiting times at accident and emergency hospitals right across the country.
Yeah, and I've just
real
come
disaster.
From...
And also, let me also just add to that, because there seems to have been an enormous cutback in social care as well. So what we're seeing is that the nurses, doctors are tearing their hair out in the hospitals and saying, well, we've got patients here that need to go into social care and there's nowhere for them to go.
Actually, I have literally... come from Southmead Hospital this afternoon, and very kindly the staff there took round counsellors and showed us the whole new hospital, and we were in accident and emergency talking to the chief of accident and emergency, and he was saying how well they were coping. And in fact, it was jolly quiet there this evening, and it was absolutely a credit to all the people working there. And also talking to the discharge sister who is responsible for discharge, and it really is very clear that it is quite difficult to get some people out of hospital. But you know, I want to say a big well done to Southmead Hospital at the moment, because they are doing a fantastic job. And yes, there are problems, but there will be in January. We're now in the worst week of flu this year, and it has been the worst flu for the last 3 years. So we are, of course, going to see pressures this month. But, you know, credit to our Bristol hospitals doing a fantastic job.
A lot of trusts, of course, across the country are actually running out of money as we're coming towards the end of the I was going to say academic year. No.
Financial year.
They're starting to run out of money. Can't hire the staff and that sort of thing. Anyway, one of the things I wanted to bring up was this article from the Independent from Ben Chu on Monday. UK manufacturers' confidence is hit by the Eurozone crisis. The return of the Eurozone crisis and the slowing of the domestic economy has seriously dented the confidence of UK manufacturers. Two surveys released today show the percentage of firms expecting conditions in Britain to deteriorate over the coming 12 months has more than tripled from 5% a year ago to 17%, according to the annual EFF Aldermore Executive Survey of the sector. Now, Claire, you're talking about the continuing the recovery. This doesn't look like that at all, does it?
It's not looking good in the Eurozone at present. And I just think we are very fortunate. Our manufacturing base now, our businesses are doing brilliantly at the moment. And I know that Europe is one of our major markets. And it is really important that we are focusing on a lot of the emerging markets as well as our existing ones. And yes, that is the nature of global, the global situation now, is that when one thing, you know, when one country is suffering, then there is a knock-on effect. And yes, I hope we can get Europe growing in a way that that Britain's been growing. We've been doing incredibly well. I really do hope that that they'd get themselves sorted out. But I have great confidence in British manufacturing and businesses. They're very innovative, and people that I've been talking to in the last few months have been taking people on. So they are seeming, this is quite a gloomy article. I don't think that's necessarily representative of all businesses.
Also, Martin, the Eurozone economy, QE, inevitable and struggling block plunges into deflation. Well, OK, so maybe you could just explain what Ben Chu means this time. That was on Wednesday this week, about deflation in Europe and what that means for us.
Well, deflation is not something that many of us have seen in our lifetimes. The last big period of deflation was during the 30s and throughout most of the period since.
What does that actually mean?
Well, it means falling prices. Now, falling prices sounds like
sounds
a good,
great.
It sounds like a good
yeah,
thing.
It's not great.
But the problem is that falling prices mean that it's very difficult for companies to make profits because they've got to sell more cheaply. And then, of course, they can't pay higher wages, and you get a downward spiral. What they're worried about here is a downward spiral taking hold, and where falls in prices lead to further falls in prices, and that we haven't really had anything, because previously inflation, there's been a bias towards inflation in Western economic systems for decades, and we've never really experienced deflation in modern times. And I think,
so why the bias towards inflation? What's good about it?
Well, the bias towards inflation, I mean, when an economy's booming or ticking along, then there tends to be pressure on things like skilled labour, useful locations for businesses, and that tends to push prices up slightly. So usually when an economy is growing in a sustainable fashion, you'd expect something like 2% inflation. Fairly normal, nothing to worry about, it's what we're used to. But of course deflation was the norm in the 30s, and of course in previous eras, deflation and inflation used to very much you'd get a period of inflation followed by deflation. What we did after the World War II is we basically eliminated deflation, which was actually, so we've all grown up in an environment in which deflation simply hasn't been there. Even in the economic crisis of the 70s, it wasn't a deflationary environment.
So what does it tell us, this, about what's going on in European?
Well, I think
economy,
what it tells us
in
is
I'm in the
not just the Eurozone. We've still got lots and lots of problems in the global economy, largely, as we all know, sourced in the financial services sector in the first place. So the danger is that we are, you know, it's not a question of British government policy, whoever the British government was. If you get, for example, a Grexit, a Greek exit from the euro, which may transpire over the next few months, that has the potential to trigger derivatives contracts in the City of London and elsewhere, which will make the banks insolvent overnight. And that's just one small country, Greece. There's other countries out there, Argentina, Russia, China even, which is starting to wobble.
Isn't it actually really even simpler than that? It's just the fact that the oil price has been going down.
that's one of the drivers of deflation, for sure, no doubt about it.
Okay, now let's go back, as I said, to have a listen now to David Cameron on the Andrew Marr Show. And here he is talking about his $30 billion. He doesn't call them cuts, he calls them adjustment. But anyway, here is David Cameron.
We've said there's another $30 billion of adjustment that needs to be made, some from tax and the rest from spending. And unlike other parties, we've been very clear where that money is coming from. So we've said five of the $30 billion comes from continuing the war against tax evasion and tax avoidance. That leaves $25 billion, of which $12 billion should be reductions in welfare spending, and we've already given some answers there. And the remaining $13 billion, that comes from continuing for two more years the reductions and efficiencies in departmental spending, in government departments, along the same lines as what we've achieved in the last 5 years. Now, that is difficult. That will take long-term decisions, but it's not impossible. It's doable. And here's the point I really want to make. Why do we need to do this? It is not some ideological obsession. It's not because we're desiccated accountants. It's because I think it's right for our country, it's right for future generations, that at the end of 7 years of economic growth, by 2018, we should start not to be borrowing, but be putting aside money for a rainy day, to be saving money for when storms in the future might hit.
Well, I think when he says it's not ideological, I think it is ideological. I was glad to hear Claire say earlier that we want to spend money on schools and hospitals, because we do. But I think some people in the Conservative Party don't really. They'd rather have a much smaller state than the one that we've got used to. And I think that will be a fairly obvious difference between the major parties in May.
Now, OK, this is a biggie, really, isn't it, Claire? Because back in 2010, we were promised, oh, we were going to actually get the books straight by now. It's not happened. And we're being told again, oh, OK, we're going to be getting the books straight by the end of the next parliamentary term. So why on earth should we believe what George Osborne, David Cameron are saying? We're going to get the books straight in 4 or 5 years' time, when they didn't manage it this time.
No, I know things have taken longer than we would have liked them to. I think the global economy has made a difference there. But, you know, I'd like to say that ideologically, we are not against schools and hospitals and a civilised society. We're into small government, which means streamlining government, which means that, you know, we're not spending money on red tape and unnecessary unnecessary admin and things like that.
There's been a massive amount of admin spent in the National Health Service making all these changes, hasn't there?
Yes, but we're seeing some really good benefits now. I mean, yesterday I was in a meeting with the local clinical commissioning group, and they are making some fantastic strides now. They know exactly what they want to be commissioning. They know exactly... you know, they're getting good value for money, and I think we're seeing some very good decision making going on now in the National Health. And it's not always about spending money, and it's not always about throwing more admin at a situation. But ideologically, you know, I come from a standpoint of common sense, and if you don't need 10 people to do something, then let's have one person to do it, because those. We're spending taxpayers' money, and you know, yet again, I'll say taxpayers want you to be careful with their money.
But you're talking about common sense here. But I mean, you know, if you're employing a private company to do some kind of important job, like in a hospital, and then they go bust, what do you do then? I mean, that's happened quite a lot. For example, a whole network of care homes went bust, Circle care homes.
Yes, and today the private hospital that was set up under Labour has the company have said that they no longer want to go forward with that, and I think it was a disaster under Labour that we did have a private NHS hospital. There are some times that privatisation is good for a situation, and sometimes it isn't. And I think you've just got to get a real balance there. And I think sometimes ideology goes too far one way or too far the other. And I think getting some middle common sense in there is always helpful.
Does it bother you that, quite particularly with the NHS, I mean, the Daily Mail about 8 months ago came out with quite a damning article saying that quite a lot of the NHS contracts are being got by people who are donors directly to the Tory party. I mean, it almost sounds like giving parts of the government away to your mates.
I don't think we're giving away parts of the NHS. I mean, I think you need to be very clear that there is a very, very small proportion still. I think it's only 6 pence in every pound spent in the NHS that's spent privately. And I think you can scaremonger that there's a privatisation going on. It's absolutely not the case. I think we're seeing some very good contracts going on. I mean, under Labour, we saw some disastrous private finance initiatives. And I think, yes, things go wrong under every government, but on the whole, we're doing pretty well.
And Claire's hit the nail on the head there, Martin, hasn't she? Because Labour started all this. Good old New Labour started the whole process of privatising the health service.
They did indeed. I was opposed to it at the time and still am opposed to it, whether it's whoever does it. I mean, the problem with private finance is it's the most expensive way to do it.
It was.
I mean, governments, especially national governments, can borrow far more cheaply than any trust hospital can borrow. Mm. And the reason they did it was because if they did it that way, it wouldn't show up as government expenditure, at least not in the current period. Mm. But of course, now we've got all of these contracts that run into the future, which have got to be serviced, till the cows come home. It was a bit silly. I mean, there was a consensus developed there, what you might call a common sense consensus, which was just wrong. Mm. And I think if we can start moving away from that as a society, then we might actually improve some things.
I think we are actually seeing that the health service renegotiate some of those contracts, and as painful as it is. We've got to do it, and we've got to come out with better value for the taxpayer.
Anyway, this week at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, this was one of the topics that came up, funnily enough. I mean, you get 6 questions, Ed Miliband, but I would have thought, I don't know if any of Ed's advisors are listening, but why don't you choose a few different topics? every time he just says the same question again and again. Same question.
Perhaps he doesn't have anything else to say.
Perhaps. But anyway, let's have a listen to him now on one of his 6 questions about the National Health Service.
Mr. Speaker, in June 2011, this was the Prime Minister's solemn promise, and I quote, "I refuse to go back to the days when people had to wait for hours on end to be seen in A&E. So let me be absolutely clear, we won't." Will he now apologise to patients across the country for having broken that promise?
I deeply regret any patient who doesn't get a good service, but let us be absolutely clear about the numbers in terms of people accessing A&E. Today, compared with 4 years ago, over 2,500 more patients are seen within 4 hours than 4 years ago. That is what's happening. Now, we knew there was pressure on our NHS, and that is why, over the last year, we've seen 1,800 more doctors in our hospitals, 4,700 more nurses in our hospitals, and 2,500 more beds in our hospitals. Now, there's more that we need to do, but let us recognise that the health service in every part of our United Kingdom faces these challenges. We must go on giving them the money, the resources, and the people so they go on providing a great service.
Prime Minister David Cameron there at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Don't you think that it's quite possible the Conservatives are going to get a bloody nose during the election over the way the NHS has gone? Because we've seen the figures over the last 2 weeks, both of them, the worst figures for waiting times on record, actually, for the last 10 years when records began.
Well, actually, I'd probably like to see those statistics, because I'm looking at newspapers and seeing graphs of varying degrees, and actually at the moment we have just, some hospitals have missed their 95% target of seeing people in under 4 hours. And that's in England. But if you actually look at the results for Wales, which the Labour Party are running the National Health Service in Wales, it's actually a lot worse. And Ed Miliband's being terribly quiet about that. And I would say that Ed Miliband's absolutely fixated with this one thing of the NHS, and it does appear that he doesn't have anything else to say. In the European elections, even last year, I had a leaflet through my door asking me to vote for Labour on the European elections with an NHS article on it, and absolutely nothing about Europe. It does worry me that Ed hasn't got anything else to say. What What actually has he got to say?
Well, I'll tell you what the Daily Telegraph's got to say. A&E crisis, NHS posts worst waiting time figures in a decade. They're saying accident and emergency departments had their worst performance in a decade. Statistics from all NHS hospital trusts show that in the last 3 months, 92.6% of patients were seen within 4 hours, the worst figure since records started in 2004. Not 4 months, thankfully, as no. David Cameron was saying there, Prime Minister's
he
questions.
Said four that years, would be. Actually,
oh, did he? So 4 years even. So it certainly is not looking good, is it? And you have to remember that this is an average right across the country. So
yeah.
Some places so are far worse.
Some places
than
are far worse, and some places are far better. And very fortunately, in Bristol, we're doing far better. I would say that I've just come from Southmead Hospital, and doctors there were saying that they are victims of their own success in some ways, because we're keeping people alive for so much longer now, which means that actually they develop more problems. We're also this year seeing the worst flu for about 3 years, and we're seeing an increasing elderly population, and all of these things are having an effect on our NHS, and I'm not going to say that we're not having problems, because we are, but I think it is a way that we solve those problems that's going to be crucial.
And in that the interview I played with Andrew Marr a bit earlier on, Claire, there was three times David Cameron said refused to rule out an alliance with UKIP after the general election. What are your thoughts about that? Would that be wise to get in bed with UKIP as part of a coalition?
I wouldn't want to get in bed with Nigel Farage. I don't think anybody else would who's listening. Perish the thought. Good grief, I can think I'd rather be dead.
There was even an interesting article saying actually there may even be a Labour Conservative, this is in the Guardian last week, a Labour Conservative coalition, because there's so much similarity between the two parties, many of their economic sides, and particularly some of the key people, you know, the Ed Balls and George Osborne, for example, have got a lot in common.
I don't think they get on particularly well, do you?
Well, they certainly do at their Bilderberg conferences, which I look at. They go along to get all their advice from the top financiers in the world together, sitting in the same room. I think they probably even share one of those little
really
love seats.
You really are making me laugh. You know what I would say about all this supposition about coalitions here, there and everywhere, is that absolutely nobody knows. And it will be up to the voters and the electorate to decide. And you know what? Then the parties will have to sort it out.
But the parties do the secret deals, don't they? Like the Lib Dems and the Tories did before the last election.
There were no secret deals before the last election. If you looked at how tired and ragged the poor guys were trying to thrash it out.
Yeah, but they were. For example, over tuition fees. You know, that came out afterwards, didn't it?
Tuition fees. The Liberal Democrats knew full well that tuition fees was a promise they could never keep. In fact, Stephen Williams has admitted that he was saying things he knew he couldn't keep, and as the university spokesman for the Liberal Democrats, I think shame on him.
Well, it's a bit naughty, isn't it, right up to general election to be actually just lying to the public. Anyway,
I think it's appalling,
Martin,
and I'm not going to make pledges I don't think I can keep.
What about this whole business of coalitions, UKIP and Tory?
Well, I mean, I think there probably won't be a party that has enough power to enough votes to form a government on its own. That's more than likely. I mean, it may happen that Labour would be that party or the Conservatives would be that party, but I don't think so. I think there's probably, which is going to be interesting. The question is, under our first past the post system, you're then going to potentially have a perverse result where UKIP might get more votes than the SNP, but the SNP are looking on course for something like 40 seats, and that would give them the balance of power, which would put them in the same kind of position as the Irish Nationalist Party in the 19th century.
Oh, crikey, and so on.
And then
you have to go back to that era.
A long way.
But things are changing.
But the Lib Dems were in that position in the run up to the, after the last election. They didn't really do anything with it, with all that leverage.
Well, no, I mean, that's the question to put to the Liberals. I think they should have done it. You know, I think they were unwise to go into coalition with the Conservative government. And what could have happened after the last election was a minority Conservative government, which, of course, in Scotland, you had a minority SNP government. And that actually was quite interesting because they were the government, but then everything they brought forward had to win. Every vote had to be won on its merits. And if we'd had a Conservative government that had to actually win every vote on its merits, then that might have been a rather interesting interesting development. But what's happened, I'm afraid, for the Liberals is that in order to get power, they were prepared to make too many concessions.
Well, that's interesting, because that would take power away from the Cabinet table and more towards the House of Commons, the people we elect.
Yes, well, I mean, that's one possible outcome. I mean, we could have a minority government at the end of the next election.
But, Claire, I mean, at the end of the day, the reason that these minority parties are starting to do a lot better is because of failures of the big main parties like yours.
Like mine, which I don't own personally. I would say I think the most important thing is that everybody votes and then you get a much clearer picture. It's when you get voter apathy and you get low turnouts, that's when we get bad government. And it might do us good to have another coalition. It might do us good to have a hung parliament. You know, I think we've had very settled governments, as you were saying, that, you know, got to go back a long way to look at, you know, when we've had crazy situations like a minority government. And we are going to have to wake up to the fact that there are a lot of views out there, and that's why it really is down to parties to be very honest with voters this time round, to be very clear about what they stand for. And, you know, I really urge people to take very seriously their right to vote, because it's your one opportunity in 5 years to try and get what you want.
Okay, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions now, and this time it's about social care, which has been cited as one of the main reasons why hospitals are finding it very difficult to have enough beds. In fact, if you look at the number of beds in our hospitals, it's gone down and down and down over the last 20-30 years, even though, of course, the population has been going up and up and up. So anyway, this particular question is from Alison McGovern on social care.
On Monday, I listened to residents of Mendel Court, an extra care facility in my constituency in Bromborough, tell me about their serious worries about social care. For the good of all of those who need care and all NHS patients, won't the Prime Minister go further to integrate health and social care?
What we're doing with the Better Care Fund is producing a fund of £5 billion, which will be money that the health and local authorities can spend together. The Labour Party, up to now, has opposed that fund and said it shouldn't be brought into place. But I'm afraid it's worse than that, because the Secretary of State, the Shadow Secretary of State for Health, has been wandering around the television studios today saying to anyone who's prepared to listen that he'd increase funding for social care. But there is only one slight problem with this, which is this is what the Shadow Chancellor has said. And he said this on the news just on the 5th of January. There will be no additional funding for local government, he said, unless we can find money from somewhere else. And we have not. We are, because if they'd waited for the end of the quote, they would have heard this, and we've not been able to do that in the case of local government. So there we are, total and utter chaos. One of them going round so there'll be extra money, another one saying there won't be any extra money. £20 billion of unfunded commitments. They would lead to total chaos in our economy and a total breakdown in our health service.
Well, the Prime Minister's talking about total chaos in our economy there. I'm afraid there is a real danger of that, and it's not necessarily to do with anything he's done. It's because the global financial system is still fundamentally insolvent, and that's what we've not been doing since the crisis of 2008. There's not been any honest discussion about it, because everybody basically wants to hear good news, that the situation is somehow resolved. The Labour Party, when it was defending its record, didn't really want to admit how bad the situation had got in the financial markets. Nobody really does. And I'm not standing for any kind of office anywhere, even as a local councillor, so I can say what I think. And the fact is that there's a real danger that the financial services sector, a lot of which is rooted in the City of London, is in fact still out of control. There's every possibility in my mind that there is going to be a further the crash, and of course that then makes all of the discussions about what we're going to do with the health service and so on. It's like rearranging the decks on the deck chairs on the Titanic.
I mean, Marty's point there about, you know, he's not standing for office, therefore he can say what he thinks. Don't you think that actually does go for quite a lot of our politicians, is that they clip their words? And you, even Claire, have to clip your words. You have to be very careful what you say.
Although when I was selected, somebody did ask me what my weakness was, and I said, well, I am not, my answer was, I am not a politician, and I may end up answering those questions that you don't want me to. And I think that will probably be one of the highlights of my campaign, was I will tend to answer questions that perhaps other politicians would try and avoid. But anybody who knows me knows I'm pretty plain speaking, and I'm not easily frightened by powers that be who might want to silence me. So I'm hoping, and I really am genuinely hoping, that I am going to say what I think and what I feel and not toe the party line just for the sake of it.
Okay, well, one person who said what you think was stockbroker Rehan Quadar. He was fired from Hargreaves Lansdown after his joke tweet, or he says it's a joke anyway, saying that he hit a cyclist and failed to stop, and then he apologised for it. He apologised for it, but is that a sackable offence, saying something like that? Maybe you first, Martin.
Well, did he actually hit the cyclist?
No, no.
So in other words, he made the whole thing up.
He made a little thing up, and he's been sacked as a result of it.
The fact is, your employer is in a position to sack you if they don't like what things you say on social media.
Gross misconduct.
Yeah, if you remember a few years ago, and I thought this was quite unfortunate. There's a 16-year-old girl in Margate, and she had put on her Facebook page that she found her job, which was in an insurance office, boring, and she was sacked on Monday morning for that. And the then head of the TUC picked up on that and said, you know, this is why we have trade unions in this country, because surely you can't just be sacked for saying your job is boring on Facebook. Mm-hmm. But of course, that is the situation these days. I mean, anybody who's employed by anybody realises that your social media presence, your employers regard that as, especially if you say something about your employment. You say, she said she found her job boring. And what her mum said at the time was, she finds Margate boring, but I haven't kicked her out of the house yet.
Well, I worked for a couple of years ago on the National Union of Journalists policy for social media, how to use social media and how not to. And a couple of tips I'd say. First of all, if you think that you're in danger of possibly getting sacked from something you said, just use a pseudonym. Simple, use a pseudonym. Yeah. And don't let anyone...
But also be very careful what you say on social media.
Yes, people, but I mean, you should
crazy.
Be able to be honest about your employment, but not necessarily being obvious about who you are that's saying it.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, I would also get one of these little social media tips is all the time people are asking you for your email address. Pick a silly Yahoo address, and then you can send all the spam to your silly Yahoo address or something like that. You don't have to have it on your main address, because this is really starts to annoy me, the way that everyone that wants anything now wants your email address. Anyway, what's your thoughts about this? Should this guy have been sacked or not, Claire?
I'm not going to say whether he should or shouldn't have been sacked. I am going to say that he shouldn't have tweeted such an absolutely stupid tweet. There's nothing remotely funny about hitting a cyclist and not stopping. And quite right, everybody's been up in arms about it. You know, jokes are jokes, and some things are really not funny. If you hit a cyclist, you are obliged to stop and call the appropriate emergency services. So I don't even know what possessed this guy. But, you know, I can understand an employer sacking them. You know, they want people of good repute. And I'm a pharmacist by profession, and it is very important that I am of good repute. If I break the law in any way, then I am up before the Pharmaceutical Society, because it is about having integrity and being of sound mind. And
the mayor weighed in on this as well, didn't he? And I mean, you just wonder sometimes if it's almost like Chinese whispers, something just gets bigger and bigger and all out of proportion, and then it hits the Huffington Post, the Daily Mail. George Ferguson waded into the row over the tweet, declaring online, "Stockbroker hit cyclist tweet has chilling echoes of 60s Deep South racism."
I think he's just needs to stop tweeting sometimes.
And now George has apologised for that. I'm not sure if he's got sacked for that one.
I think sometimes, you know, to tweeters out there, just because something pops into your head, do not feel that you really must put it into print, because basically when you tweet, you are publishing, and that gets you into all sorts of trouble.
Something for politicians running for office to remember very, very much.
Absolutely.
So I think one of the real problems with social media is, because all politicians have to be on it these days, but that's three times an hour for you to put your foot in your mouth.
Absolutely. And be very careful about never tweeting when you're angry or drunk or just in a bad mood. you know, always, you know, if in doubt, probably don't press the tweet button.
And your councillor, Conservative councillor John Galandris, I don't think he's on social media. He's
don't think John is, no.
No, so tell us a bit about him. Who is this guy? I keep trying to get him on
the
show.
Lovely Mr.
Galandris. Talk to the city, yeah, but he won't come.
Oh, well, he's a very busy man. He does have a full-time job, and that's probably
why. He's a bit of a dark horse, isn't he?
He's not a dark horse. He's adorable. And you must come along to full council and hear him in full swing. I think he works for a bank. He's very hardworking.
Coutts, the Royal
Coutts,
Bank.
I think, yeah.
He looks after the Queen's money.
Well, I think he looks after a lot of people's money, and I think I would trust him with mine. But I just hasten to add, I do not bank with Coutts. No, John's a lovely guy. He's been a fantastic councillor for many years. He's our chief whip and a diligent man, and I'm sure one day you'll get him on this programme.
Okay, well, I hope so. Anyway, on to talking of royals, Prince Andrew, sex allegations.
Oh,
documents
dear.
About the Duke of York's support for Jeffrey Epstein have been concealed by a US court, apparently. Documents that could reveal the extent of any lobbying by Prince Andrew on behalf of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein being kept out of the public eye after the millionaire financier obtained a court order declaring any such material confidential. Lawyers acting for a woman who claims that she was forced to sleep with the Duke of York when she was a teenager alleged that he vouched for Epstein while the billionaire financier was negotiating a plea bargain with US prosecutors about an investigation into sex with underage girls. Just to stress that this is in the state of Florida, where the age of consent is 17. It's slightly different to the law here in Britain. But this is a bit embarrassing for Prince Andrew, Martin, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I can imagine the Queen's probably not amused.
And what do you make of this guy, Jeffrey Epstein? Because he seems to be at the centre of this. Andrew's a little bit unwise, isn't he?
Well, I mean, the other person...
To be involved
with this chap. There are various other people.
And yet he's been defending him to the hilt for years. And this guy's actually now a convicted paedophile,
too. Well, listen, these things are now being investigated. So let's not jump to any conclusions until everything has been properly looked into. I think... It doesn't take much imagination to imagine that very powerful guys who've got lots of money and all the rest of it are tempted to use that power in unfortunate ways. I mean, the island that Epstein runs in the Bahamas, where various politicians and celebrities we used to go for, rest and recreation, I suspect all sorts of rather unfortunate things were going on there. And...
Very unwise for Andrew to be involved with this guy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the point is that we're not even... It's not even clear what we shouldn't be chucking... But let's just let everything develop properly. If he's done these things, then he should be punished according to the law, but he should be given the basic presumption that he's innocent until proven guilty.
Absolutely, I totally agree.
Well, and also Epstein's lawyer has filed Alan Dershowitz's lawyers filed defamation suits against two other US lawyers he's accused of having sex with Virginia Roberts when she was a minor. Basically, what he's trying to do, he's trying to get her, this is the so-called victim in all this, well, we don't know because it's not been through court. And he's trying to get her lawyers sacked. So this is all rather nasty. It's over in the States, so we can talk about it here, the court case, at least some of it. And I think this is certainly one to be following with interest. But it just goes to show that there seems to be this sort of other world that rich and powerful live in, Martin.
Well, yes, and of course we've got the investigation into elite paedophilia in this country, where they haven't been able to find anybody suitably independent to run the inquiry.
And now allegations of murder too.
Yes, and of course the real problem with all of this is that paedophilia has been used by intelligence services as a form of blackmail. That's what's underlying all of this. Heyman, who was second in command of MI6, definitely fingered as one of the perpetrators of these. It looks like they've got various safe houses where sex with underage children has been going on. But of course, that's brilliant if you want to blackmail people.
But that's the trouble, is it could be being used, maybe even still being used as political blackmail.
Well, in King Corriboy's home in Northern Ireland was being used by MI5 as a honey trap operation. Everybody on all sides in Northern Ireland knows what went on. It's not been properly investigated. Bizarrely enough, King Corra has been excluded from the inquiry here on the grounds that it's in a different jurisdiction from Britain.
Well, the inquiry
we're
now told, even though people have given evidence to it, may not happen anyway. What do you make of this mess? It's in Theresa May's inbox. What do you think she should be doing, Claire?
I think Theresa is probably very disappointed that this investigation hasn't got off the ground. I know that that's something that she takes very seriously.
But why is she appointing establishment people to run it in the first place?
I think sometimes we can perhaps overreact. When you know somebody, doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be swayed by that person. And I'm not going to say whether it was a right or wrong decision. We need to get an independent person to chair this commission and get on with it. And I think Theresa May's made it very, very clear that nobody is above the law, and we do need to get to the bottom of it. And I think once it gets underway, we will leave no stone unturned. And I mean, I know Theresa is very passionate about justice. She's not partial. She'll have no truck with anybody just because they're in a place of power or in the so-called establishment. She will want to get to the bottom of it. You know, she's a jolly busy woman and she's had her hands full generally, and I'm sure she's going to get a hold of this one.
But she's up against some pretty powerful forces, possibly criminal forces too, that really don't want to go to jail and certainly don't want that evidence given against them.
She's a very strong woman and she'll get to the bottom of that.
But will any of this evidence come out before the general election?
Because probably not before the general election, but I think we will get to the bottom of it, and I think sometimes these things take time. I don't know whether it's historic abuse and it is an historic problem. And we do need to get to the bottom of it. I think rushing something is always a bad move because you don't get the truth. But at the same time, dragging your heels isn't helpful either. And I think that hopefully in the next month or so, we'll get somebody chairing this commission and we will get to the bottom of it. I would say very strongly, nobody is above the law, whether you're a politician, a prince, or, I don't care if you're the King of Mars. It's the law.
It seems, Martin, that for this kind of offence, this paedophilia and this kind of thing, that the only people really outed as part of this ring have been people who are dead. What do you think this time is the chance of anything happening? Because this has bubbled up in the 1980s, bubbled up again in the 1990s, and was kicked out into the long grass.
Well, I mean, these things do take a long time, and inevitably, I mean, things that people say, oh, that's conspiracy theory and so on, and then later on it turns out, no, that's exactly what went on, sometimes. I think we're going to... What I think people need to focus on is that this elite paedophilia is probably linked to blackmail by intelligence agents and the security services. That's certainly how Kinkora was being used. So loyalist paramilitaries were being taken there to have sex with underage boys and being filmed by MI5 so that they were then blackmailable by the security services. Now, if that is normal practice, and I suspect the iceberg we're looking at suggests that it is normal practice or has been normal practice, then that's the real problem here, because paedophilia is goes all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life can get involved in paedophilia, but it's the abuse of power plus paedophilia which is the real issue. Yeah.
Well, BBC looked at this back in the 1990s in a programme called Westminster's Secret Service. So let's have a listen to former Tory whip Tim Fortescue talking about the way it worked when there was rumours running around within his party that there were embarrassing allegations or embarrassing facts to do with some of his MPs.
Anyone with any sense who was in trouble would come to the whips and tell them the truth and say, now this, I'm in a jam, can you help? It might be debt, it might be a scandal involving small boys, or any kind of scandal which a member seemed likely to be mixed up in, they'd come and ask if we could help. And if we could, we did. And we would do everything we can, because we would store up brownie points. That sounds a pretty nasty reason, but it's one of the reasons, is if we can get a chap out of trouble, then he'll do as we ask forevermore.
Well, it certainly sounds like some of the Tory whips were finding out all sorts of horrific allegations about things that were been going on with MPs in their party. But anyway, let's move on to a final story tonight, which is the hidden homeless living in caves and air raid shelters as temperatures plummet below freezing. This was at the end of, end of December, 30th of December. Many have been, this is in the Mirror, many have been hit by a spiral of benefit sanctions and rent arrears, and some are suffering Victorian diseases such as trench foot. Shocking extent of the hidden homeless sleeping rough has been revealed, with many sleeping in caves and air raid shelters. The spiral of benefit sanctions and rent arrears. Some are suffering Victorian diseases such as trench foot. Homeless organisations say frightening cuts mean more hostels could shut. Numbers could soar even further. An investigation by Manchester Evening News found insecure jobs, benefit changes and funding cuts have combined to spark a visible surge in rough sleeping. And official figures show the number of homeless people in Greater Manchester streets is 24. But charities know that the figure is far higher, believing around 150 people are now sleeping rough in the city centre. Now, Claire, this is a result of the cuts, isn't it? What we've got is a kind of underclass that are just trying to scrabble for a living off of nothing.
I think that it's a result of an awful lot of problems. I think you will always find that homelessness, people that are homeless have multiple issues, and not least mental health issues and addictions. And it's something that I take incredibly seriously. In fact, next week I'm visiting the 1625 Independent People Charity and was supporting their Sleep Out for the Homeless just before Christmas. Homelessness is an absolute tragedy, and it is something that unfortunately we have lived with for far too long. I would say that every case should be treated individually. It's not always benefits. Sometimes it is. Often it's family breakdown, is mental health issues. And I always have given my support to homelessness charities. Is something that I worked in. Well, I mean,
the other thing we're hearing, of course, is that although there's more people in work, the work that they're in is not paying the rent, it's not paying electricity, and if you don't pay the rent, you get evicted.
I think that's why we're working to see that the minimum wage goes up and that the minimum wage is never taxed. And that's something that we're working towards. I think as we're seeing jobs increase, we're going to be seeing the quality of jobs increase. I think, yes, we do have some problems with spiralling rental costs and other living costs. And, it is a problem and we need to get hold of it. But we need to be supporting these charities and anybody who's working with the homeless, because it is a tragedy in our country.
Martin, just to get you on this, that one of these homeless workers in Manchester is saying, whereas before most homeless people had some benefits, now they've got nothing at all, no money at all.
I think a major issue is that we haven't really invested in social housing in this country under various governments for decades.
Absolutely.
But what about people just not having any money, literally having to beg for food?
One of the benefits reforms is that private landlords for private rented won't rent to people on benefits anymore, because the payments are going to be made. The IDS has decided that he wants people to manage their own money, which is a good aspiration, I suppose. But of course, landlords don't want that. They want the money paid directly to them. And that's a fixable thing.
OK, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Horfield and standing in the general election. I think it's Bristol West.
It is Bristol West. Thanks
That's
for having me.
Claire Hiscourt.
It's been a pleasure.
After the Murdoch News, the perils of tabloid journalism and France.
Award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.